Okay then, brethren, I think you know, as we mentioned already, today is the seventh day and the final day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. It is a holy day. Of course, it's also this year a Friday. And if you look around you, most people are not keeping this day holy. Most people are out at work or maybe shopping. I guess if they're teachers or school children, they're at school. People are doing a million things today. But how many, or perhaps how few, are keeping one of God's appointed holy days? The answer is not many. And of course, we do like to remind ourselves as to why we do what we're doing. Let's turn in our Bibles, first of all, to that famous chapter, Leviticus 23. Leviticus 23. And we'll read verses 1 and 2 to start with. Leviticus 23. And picking up in verse 1 and then 2. The Lord Jehovah spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, and say to them, the feasts of Moses, which you shall proclaim..." Oh, no, sorry, not quite that. "The feast of the Jews, which you shall proclaim..." No, got that wrong still. "The feasts of the Lord, the feasts of Jehovah, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, these are my feasts, says God." So this is like plain. These are not the Jewish holy days. They're not Israel's holy days. They're not Moses' days. They're not mankind's days. Right? Scripture's plain. These are God's days, God's appointed times. That's what the Hebrew actually means here. Dropping down to verses 4 through 8. "These are the feasts of the Lord, holy convocations, which you shall proclaim at their appointed times. On the 14th day of the first month at twilight is the Lord's Passover." And we kept that about a week ago. "On the 15th day of the same month is the Feast of Unleavened Bread to the Lord. 7 days you must eat unleavened bread." And we kept that first holy day, last Saturday. Verse 7. "On the first day you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work on it, but you shall offer an offering made by fire to the Lord for 7 days." When there was a temple, you could do that. And then notice, latterly, "The seventh day shall be a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work on it." And that's today, the seventh day. It's a holy assembly, a coming together of God's people, ideally, together physically, but for many of us today, it's together over the internet or by telephone hookups and so on. But as far as we can, we come together, we assemble together on God's holy assembly. And today is a holy day. Now, we know that God is working out an eternal purpose. And as part of that, he has given us his feast days for a reason. Now, we covered this quite a lot last week. These days are to teach us lessons. And they act as a sort of annual reminder as well. Because every year, hopefully, we keep Passover. Every year we keep the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Every year we keep Pentecost and so on. So we go around this sort of this cycle, this circle, year after year after year. It's a good reminder. Things that might be in danger of slipping away, we get a reminder once a year, at least. And last week, if you were with us, we looked at the meaning of leaven, how putting out leaven pictures the putting away of sin and also false teaching from our lives. And then the other part was that eating unleavened bread pictures our living right, just like Jesus did. And we're not going to repeat that today. Now, the ancient Passover, that very first Passover, was an absolutely major event in the history of God's people. you know, God took a slave people out of bondage in one of the world's great empires. He was leading them to a promised land of milk and honey. And the Bible gives us many, many details, many, many chapters devoted to the story and the journey of ancient Israel on that exodus immediately following Passover. And one of the reasons, at least, why there's so much detail there is because there are so many lessons there surrounding the exodus involved with Passover that you and I are hopefully supposed to learn. So today I want to review some of those lessons. We can check ourselves out how we're doing as we compare our walk towards God's kingdom with the walk of ancient Israel going towards their promised land, their exodus from Egypt. How did they do? How are we doing? So let's look at 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and read the first 13 verses. So 1 Corinthians 10. You know, some people don't really like the Old Testament. They call themselves New Testament Christians. Spend your time in the New Testament. Well, I get that. Some of it's a bit easier to understand. May seem a bit more relevant. But the Old Testament is there for a purpose. And when it says all scripture is given by inspiration of God and profitable, the only such scripture existing at the time that Paul wrote that to Timothy was the Old Testament scriptures. So they're vitally important. And it brings it out even here at chapter 10 of 1 Corinthians, verse 1. And moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. So Paul's talking about ancient Israel and their departure from Egypt, how they followed Moses, how they went through the Red Sea, which was like a sort of, you know, baptism, going under the water, so to speak. And that sounds pretty good. Notice the reference there to all our fathers, all passed through the sea, all baptized, all ate the same food, all drank the same drink. All of them did. All of them did. They all did. They were all heading off to the promised land. All of them were. But, verse 5, but, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. They died there. Most of them died there. They all left. But of the adults, only, well, you know the number, only two arrived in the promised land. That's probably 1 to 2 million adults, and only two survived the journey. Woo! Now, is that important to us, or just something of, you know, academic interest? Well, verse 6 says, now these things became our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. So Paul's saying, this is important for us. These are our examples, that we shouldn't do what they did. So these things are written down, and they're valuable not just as a piece of history, but as information that we, that's you and me today, need. Carrying on. And do not become idolaters, as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. We'll read that later in its context. Verse 8, nor let us commit sexual immorality, as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us, so, you know, notice Paul's bringing the lessons from the days of the Exodus back to him and to his readers. Well, that's you and me today. Verse 9, nor let us tempt Christ as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents, nor murmur, which means grumble, be always complaining.
Uh-oh.
Now, we'll see that when we get there. That's a common theme. These people grumbled and complained and grumbled and criticized and complained endlessly. Of course, surely there's no risk that you and I would be people
absolutely
prone to grumbling.
Not.
Of course not. No. It's just them in those days, but thankfully not us today. It says, verse 10, nor murmur, as some of them also murmured and were destroyed by the destroyer. Well, maybe God doesn't like grumbling.
Uh-oh.
Verse 11, now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, on whom the ends of the ages have come. So written down for whom? Well, not for them. They didn't read this. They died in the wilderness. They didn't have Bibles in their day. These things are written down for our admonition, or the margin says our instruction. Or another one says our warning. Verse 12, therefore, guys and gals, therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall. Check ourselves out. Applies to you, applies to me. Don't become like, say, the Laodiceans, you know, rich and increased with wealth and totally self-sufficient. No, be careful. Verse 13, no temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, which is good news. He will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation, wherever it might be, will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear. So I guess just like, you know, the Red Sea opened up and ancient Israel was allowed to escape from the chasing Pharaoh and his armies, God can perform miracles in our lives, no matter how bad or serious or how long lasting the temptation or trial might be. God is faithful. God is faithful. And he will make a way for us if we're, you know, faithful to him. So we're going to review some of these stories from the ancient Exodus. And think also, just before we leave this point, Paul is writing to Corinth. And Corinth would be made up, I'm sure, of some Jews who may have converted to Jesus as Messiah, but equally, it would be, I guess, a significant number of Gentiles in the Corinthian church. Corinth was in Greece, after all. And here's Paul saying to the church audience, with many, many Gentiles there, we need to read these things about ancient Israel and their exodus and their journey and learn from it. So this is applicable no matter who we are. So let's pick up the story in Numbers 14. Numbers 14. I'm going to read verses 19 to 24. So Numbers 14. Numbers 14. And for now, verses 19 to 24. What happened at this point? And we'll read the rest of it a bit later, if we've still got time. But basically, Israel had provoked God once too often. And he was about to destroy them, all of them. And Moses interceded and said, don't do that. And he reasoned with God, and God listened to Moses and did not there and then destroy the people. So we pick up in verse 19. Moses says, pardon the iniquity of this people, I pray, according to the greatness of your mercy, just as you've forgiven his people from Egypt, even until now. There have been a number of rebellions, a number of times they'd provoked God, and he'd forgiven them again and again and again. Verse 20, then the Lord said, I have pardoned according to your word, but truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord, because all these men who have seen my glory and the signs which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness and have put me to the test now these 10 times, and have not heeded my voice, they certainly shall not see the land of which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who rejected me see it." So these people had provoked God many times. Verse 22 says, "They have put me to the test." I think one translation says, "They've provoked me now these 10 times. Now, it's not a good idea, I would have thought, to provoke God even once. Do it 10 times, really? Yes. You've got some sort of suicide complex. And so on 10 occasions, they provoked the great God. And eventually, even though God is patient, there is a line that people can cross, and they had crossed it. Continuing in verse 24, "But my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit in him and has followed me fully, I will bring into the land where he went, and his descendants shall inherit it." There was also Joshua. So Joshua and Caleb, they went across into the promised land, but everybody else, every other adult, age 20 and above, they died. And why? Well, because, verse 22, they provoked God 10 different times. So today's message is entitled, The 10 Provocations. The 10 Provocations. And we'll look at all 10. And obviously the intention is, well, partly we're just seeing the history of God's people. But equally, these things are written down for our admonition. There are lessons here, different lessons perhaps for you and me. And we want to learn what we can. Better to learn it by reading of others' mistakes than, you know, doing them ourselves. So for the very first provocation, let's look at Exodus 14. Exodus 14. This is provocation number one. Didn't take long, by the way, because Exodus 12 is the Exodus, the Passover. So chapter 14 is pretty much within a day or two. We pick up the story in Exodus 14 and verse 5. So the people have gone off on that night to be much remembered. And pretty much immediately the Pharaoh regrets his actions. Verse 5. "Now it was told the king of Egypt that the people had fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people. And they said, 'Why have we done this, that we have let Israel go from serving us?'" I thought it was fairly obvious. I mean, your country's in ruins. All the crops have been destroyed, eaten up by locusts and fire and brimstone. The firstborn are all dead. It's pretty obvious why you've let them go, because you wouldn't survive another plague. But anyway, they've got very short memories. Verse 6, "So he made ready his chariot and took his people with him. Also he took 600 choice chariots and all the chariots of Egypt with captains over every one of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel. And the children of Israel went out with boldness. So the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army." It wasn't just a few hundred chariots, the army was there as well, "and overtook them camping by the sea beside Pi-hahiroth before Baal-zephon." Now, I suppose we can't be 100% sure, but Josephus, the Jewish historian from the sort of 60s or 70s AD, in his history of the Jewish people, he says there were 600 chariots, 50,000 horsemen, that's 50,000 cavalry, and 200,000 foot soldiers. So that's like a quarter of a million trained military men coming after slave people who are at this point, unfortunately, trapped, because they're in a sort of valley. There's mountains to the north, to the south, to the east of them. There is the Red Sea, which is about 8 miles across. You can't just swim across. And on the other side, coming towards them, is a quarter million army. So you're in a difficult position. Verse 10, and when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. I wonder what they cried out. Great God, you've worked marvelous miracles. You are our God. We trust you. We stand here in faith and watch you kick the stuffing out of these Egyptians. Is that what they said? No. Verse 11, they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians? This was as slaves, don't forget. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than we should die in the wilderness. Where is their faith? Well, of course, there's none. They're convinced they're going to die. And they're turning on Moses, because it's not really Moses, is it? Moses is God's messenger. You should have left us alone. We were happier to be a slave people under taskmasters, to have the baby boys thrown into the Nile and drown. We're happier to be slaves. Why have you brought us out here to kill us? So it's the first sort of rather serious problem within just about 3 days probably of leaving. They're completely negative. They want to go back. They prefer perhaps to be in the world. And there are problems as they obey God and go God's way. And has that ever happened in our lives? That as we try to leave Egypt, leave our past, that problems arise? We're hemmed in by mountains to the north and the south and difficulties to the west, and we can't go to the east because big obstacles there. We've got job problems now. We've got the Sabbath is causing problems. We've got family disputes. What do? Give up? Go back into the world? That's sort of what they were thinking. Let's carry on, verses 13 onwards. And Moses said to the people, do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. You might have thought, since they'd seen 10 plagues already, and the complete destruction of Egypt, that they'd have a bit more faith than to start panicking and be fearful so quickly. I guess they get very short memories. And the Lord said to Moses, why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward. But lift up your rod, stretch out your hand over the sea, and divide it, which of course you do all the time. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. And I indeed will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. So I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, his chariots, and his horsemen. Then the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, when I have gained honor for myself over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen. And the angel of God who went before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud went from before them and stood behind them. So it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. Thus it was a cloud and darkness to the one, and it gave light by night to the other, so that the one did not come near the other all that night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. So, I mean, if you've seen the Ten Commandments, starring Ben-Hur, then it was, you'll remember the, sort of the attempt to display this. You know, here's the people on dry land and many stories high, the sea on both sides of you. I mean, it's an enormous miracle, and they see it. The people are in on dry land, walking, and apparently it's about 8 miles across at this point, you know, roughly. That would take you, you know, 3 or 4 hours to walk across. It's a real experience for them. And you'd think, well, surely, having seen the 10 plagues in Egypt, and now they're going through the Red Sea on dry ground, and it's, you know, balancing to each side of them, this would be a convincing miracle that they'd never forget. Well, doesn't seem to work that way. Verse 23, and the Egyptians pursued and went after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. So they thought, well, you know, what's good for the Israelites is good for us. I'd have been nervous personally if I was an Egyptian thinking, you know what, there's not much left of our country, and you know, my elder brother, the firstborn, is dead, and my father, who's the firstborn, he's also dead, as Moses had predicted. I think I'll just watch from the shore here. I might have done that, I think, personally. But
you're a coward.
Anyway, they went in, or maybe they were driven in. Now, it came to pass in the morning watch that the Lord looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud, and he troubled the army of the Egyptians. He took off their chariot wheels. One thing you can't do in a chariot is go at high speed with no wheels. So he took off their chariot wheels, so they drove with difficulty. Well, I'm not sure you'd drive at all with no wheels. I've heard the song, you know, three wheels on my wagon. You can certainly go with three wheels on, two wheels on my wagon, and the Cherokees are after me. I know that song, but no wheels on your wagon? And the Egyptian said, let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians. And the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea, that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians, on their chariots and on their horsemen. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth, while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. And so the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. And then the waters returned and covered the chariots, the horsemen, and all the army of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. Not so much as one of them remained. There are some photographs going around at the moment. You may have seen, which purport at least to show you chariot wheels deep underwater in this stretch of the Red Sea. I'm not sure it's 100% accepted, but there's certainly a lot of footage of these divers who go down, and there are chariots and chariot wheels which have been found, you know, deep in the water. Verse 29, but the children of Israel had walked on dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. And so the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Thus Israel saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt, and so the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. Well, thank heavens for that. The people have learned the lesson. You know, they're a bit frightened earlier on, but they've seen this fantastic miracle, and that's it. They're now convinced. Never again will they doubt God. Well, not until the next chapter anyway. So let's pick up the second provocation in Exodus 15, reading verses 22 to 26. Verse 22. So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, so that's where we just were, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. Not a problem. Our God is a great God, miracle-working God, and we've seen his salvation, and, you know, we're believers. Now, when they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore, the name of it was called Marah, meaning bitter. And the people murmured against Moses, saying, what shall we drink? So, 3 days? Is that all it's taken? And now the people are murmuring. They are grumbling. It only mentions it, you know, briefly in the verse. But we'll see this was a chronic problem, a continuing problem. They murmured. For any reason and every reason, there was no point anywhere where you could see them saying, we trust God, we'd be patient and watch for his great salvation. The first thing they would do is murmur, complain. It's instant. And at verse 24, the people murmured against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink, Moses?" So he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree. When he cast it into the waters were made sweet. There he, God, made a statute and an ordinance for them. And there he tested them and said, "If you diligently heed the voice of the Lord your God," which we all should do, "and do what is right in his sight, give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. I am Jehovah Rapha. I am God, your physician." Now, of course, the people, it's quite evident what the problem is. They walk by sight. They have no faith. At least you can't see much. They always go by what they see, and they're quick to grumble and complain. They are quick to doubt. So here they are doubting, they are complaining. This appears to be the second time that they disappoint God. Let's move on to the third, which is immediately following chapter 16, verses 1 through 5. "And they journeyed from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month, after they departed from the land of Egypt." So that's just a month has passed. You know, the first feast day is the 15th of the first month. This is the 15th day of the second month, so you know, about 4 weeks has gone by. "Then the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness." Already? Right? "And the children of Israel said to them, 'Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt.'" You want to provoke God? "When we sat by the pots of meat, the stew, when we ate bread to the full." Oh, those days of old. All those burgers and those cupcakes and all the delicious food we used to have in Egypt when we were slaves and our baby boys were thrown into the Nile. You know, selective memory, isn't it, really? Just remember the good times in the past, in the world. "For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." You're going to kill us all, Moses. Are they grumbling? You bet they're grumbling. What are they thinking about? Their stomachs. They are walking by sight. They've got no appetite for any hardship. Any discomfort? Do they see God anywhere? Doesn't look like it. You know, Moses, we want to go back to the flesh pots of Egypt. Those burger bars, those spices, that fish. And we're going to die out here where you've brought us. You've brought us out here. And they don't see God, do they? And of course, God, you know, meets them where they are, so to speak. Verses 4 and 5. "The Lord said to Moses, 'Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you.'" How do you do that? You don't get bread from heaven, do you? "And the people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day, that I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not. And it shall be in the sixth day that they shall prepare what they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily." And this, of course, is going to be the manna that God will bring down, you know, day by day, at least for 6 days a week. And it's going to provide for them. So they've grumbled, they've complained, they've looked back at their former lives in the world, and they're sort of longing to go back to that. But God meets them, meets their needs. And so surely by now they're learning that, you know what, God gives us water, God gives us food out here in the desert. God's on our side. He's taking us to a land flowing with milk and honey, as his word says, and we're content. We were naughty boys, complaining, but we've learned our lesson. Well, at least until halfway through the chapter. So Exodus 16, verses 16 to 20.
The fourth provocation.
Which is the fourth provocation. There's still only a month out of Egypt, Exodus 16, verses 16 to 20. This is the thing which the Lord has commanded, let every man gather it, this is the manna, according to each one's need. One omer for each person, according to the number of persons, let every man take for those who are in his tent. And the children of Israel did so and gathered, some more, some less. So when they gathered it by omers, he who gathered much had nothing over, he who gathered little had no lack. Every man had gathered according to each one's need. Of course, why would you gather much? Well, probably because you get no faith in God. Basically said, well, I know you sent it today, but you never know what God's going to do. There might be no more ever. This could be the last. Let's make sure we pile it up, pile it high, because you just can't trust this being, can you? So Moses said, verse 19, let no one leave anything till morning, notwithstanding. They did not heed Moses, but some of them left part of it until morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was angry with them because they were, well, firstly, just simply disobedient. But the reason for the disobedience was almost certainly they distrusted God. They doubted God. They relied on what they saw. And they're going to store it up because, you know, as they'd heard the preachers of those days, you just never know what God's going to do. And so Moses is angry. Can you bet your boots that God's not very impressed either? Because he says, I'm going to test them whether they'll walk in my way or not. Well, he's found out, hasn't he? A lot of them will not. And our fifth provocation is immediately following, which starting in verse 23 through 30. So Moses said to them, this is what the Lord has said. Tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. What? Already? We haven't got to Mount Sinai yet. We haven't got to the Old Covenant yet. We haven't got to the Ten Commandments yet. You mean the Sabbath was in existence before the Ten Commandments were given in Exodus 20? Really? Well, the answer is yes, of course, it's really there. It's been there since the creation. So verse 23, he said to them, this is what the Lord has said. Tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake today. Boil what you will boil. Lay off yourselves all that remains to be kept until morning. This is the one day in the week when a further miracle would happen, and it wouldn't, you know, stink overnight. It would remain fresh into the Sabbath. So you'd be there for the Sabbath, and you haven't got to go out and collect it. So God's, if you like, ensuring the sanctity of his Sabbath day with yet another miracle. Verse 24, so they laid it up till morning as Moses commanded, and it did not stink, nor were there any worms in it. Whoa, that's marvelous. Then Moses said, eat that today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, there will be none. Now it happened, of course, that some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather, but they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, hang on a second, sonny boy. How long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? Again, notice, this is before Exodus 20. It's before any old covenant. God has commandments and laws already, one of which is keep the Sabbath holy. Keep the Sabbath holy. And of course, you and I might just remember that. Many of us have kept the Sabbath for many years, but does it become a bit sort of familiar? A bit easygoing? A bit casual? Remember the lessons we're learning here. We're checking out what they did. Well, certainly some of them had no respect for God, no respect for his Sabbath day. Carrying on verse 29 and 30. See, for the Lord has given you the Sabbath. He's given us the Sabbath. Therefore he gives you on the sixth day bread for 2 days. Let every man remain in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day, and I'm sure some were grumbling. Why does God do it this way? Why can't he do it another way? So when these people go out into the fields looking for manna on the seventh day, disobeying God, showing a lack of respect for God, even though God's actually there among them, that's would be quite provocative. You know, God was angry. What are they doing? Why are they out in the fields? Why aren't they behaving? Why aren't they staying indoors? Why aren't they resting on this special day where I performed an extra miracle to keep the manna fresh? Well, they're just being plain provocative. If we move on to our sixth provocation, which is merely one chapter later, so they come, you know, pretty fast. We still haven't got to Mount Sinai. We're now up to six provocations. So picking up in chapter 17 and reading verses 1 through 7. Then all the congregation of the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped in Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. And you might have thought by now that they might have learned a lesson. You know, God provides. We've had food. We've had bitter water turn sweet. We've been saved through the miracle at the Red Sea. God clearly is on our side. Moses is quite clearly his servant. There's no water, but I guess we'll see God's marvelous miracle-working power even here. What a wonderful opportunity to see the hand of God at work. That's what you might have thought. Only, of course, that's not the way it works. Verse 2, therefore the people contended with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. And Moses said to them, why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord? Because that's what it was. It is doubt. In fact, it's more than doubt. It's almost a sort of belief that God will not look after us. It's a belief that God will not provide for us. It's a belief that God's bringing us out here and somewhere along the line, he's going to kill us. We don't know where. We don't know when, because you just never know with God. But somewhere along the line, he's going to drop us in it. And he's not going to turn up, and he's going to leave us to die. That's more or less what they were implying by their conduct. Verse 3, and the people thirsted there for water, and the people murmured against Moses, you know, grumbling, and said, why is it you've brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, what shall I do with these people? They are almost ready to stone me. This wasn't just a mild disagreement. A couple of elders walk up to Moses and say, people are a bit upset, Moses. I mean, they're really thirsty, and it's quite warm out here, and there's not much water. I mean, it's just not nice for them. They're ready to pick up some boulders in the wilderness and bury Moses under them. And the Lord said to Moses, go on before the people, take with you some of the elders of Israel, take in your hand your rod with which you struck the river, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock in Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. So we're talking about, you know, God can do almost anything, can't he? I mean, you and I might think, in this situation, even God couldn't do something to help me. Even God couldn't meet my needs, so I'm entitled to grumble and complain and whinge and be negative and depress everybody around me. Because God can't help me. God wouldn't help me. Well, this is what they were doing all the time. And God pretty much can turn any situation around. Verse 7. So he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah. Massah means temptation. Meribah means contention or provocation. So it names the place after the lousy attitudes they're showing. So he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah because of the contention, the provocation of the children of Israel, and because they tempted the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? Ooh, That sounds highly dangerous to me. Is God among us or not? Well, God's there. He is among them, literally. And he's watching. And he's hearing. He's observing. And I guess he's just not at all pleased. Is God with us or not? You didn't see all the miracles up till now? You weren't in Egypt when 10 plagues brought the country to its knees? You didn't walk through the Red Sea just a few weeks ago? You missed all that, did you? You were asleep. And so this is really insulting to God, very provocative. Let's move on to the seventh provocation. This is now past Sinai a little bit, so it's Exodus 32. Well, that actually is at Sinai, think about it, but it's just after the Ten Commandments. Still at Mount Sinai. In fact, Moses is still up the mountain, I think, at this point. So our seventh provocation, Exodus 32, and beginning verses 1 through 6. Now, when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron, or actually against Aaron, and said to him, "Come, make us gods that shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what's become of him." Can this possibly be real? They're actually at Mount Sinai. They heard God's voice only a week or two or three earlier. They heard the Ten Commandments, one of which says, don't make any graven images unto you and bow down to them. They're actually there. This is the scene, the spot. And they're saying to Aaron, we want some idols. Verse 2, Aaron said, go away. We must be obedient to the great Almighty God. He was performing great miracles as he takes us to a land of promise. Unfortunately, Aaron says, okay, break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, your daughters. Bring them to me. So all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. He received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a molded calf. This is the golden calf. Then they said, this is your God, O Israel, that brought you up out of the land of Egypt. Are you kidding me? This golden calf is your God, O Israel? I mean, what sort of magic mushrooms were these people eating? Verse 5, so when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it. When you're in a hole, you should stop digging. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. The Lord, by the way, is up the mountain which they're camped beside. Then they rose early the next day, offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. And we read this back in 1 Corinthians 10. Now, the Hebrew apparently implies it was a bit more than just rising up to play cards or tennis. The Good News Bible says, the people sat down to a feast, which turned into an orgy of drinking and sex. So the Hebrew implies the play was of a particular type of playing. Not recommended when God's on the mountain right beside you. And so God sees it all, not impressed. Verse 7, the Lord said to Moses, go, get down, for your people, whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. I always do think that's a little bit unfair, because, your people, Moses, that you brought up. I think Moses might have felt a wee bit sort of aggrieved at that. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. Quickly? It's days since the Ten Commandments were given. They have made themselves a molded calf and worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, this is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. I mean, God saw all that. He's there. And the Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people. Indeed, it is a stiff-necked, stubborn, rebellious people. Now, therefore, let me alone that my wrath may burn hot against them, that I may consume them. That's destroy them. And I'll make of you a great nation. But that's it. They provoke me once too often. I'm going to wipe them out. I'm going to start again, Moses, with you. And, you know, and thankfully, you know, Moses intercedes and said, well, don't do that. I mean, your reputation would be damaged. You know, please, please, please forgive them. So verses 19, you know, Moses hurries down the mountain. God's going to not destroy them this time. That comes a bit later. So it was, as soon as Moses came near the camp, verse 19, he saw the calf and the dancing. So Moses' anger became hot, and he cast the tablets out of his hands, that's the Ten Commandments, and broke them at the foot of the mountain. Then he took the calf which they had made, burned it in the fire, ground it to powder, scattered it on the water, and made the children of Israel drink it. And Moses said to Aaron, what did this people do to you that you brought so great a sin upon them? And Aaron said, do not let the anger of my Lord become hot. Well, of course, Moses is his younger brother, actually, but obviously the pecking order. Moses is right up with God, and Aaron at this moment is probably quite a long way from God. You know the people, that they are set in evil. I mean, what can you do with this bunch? I mean, they're just rebels, and they're dangerous, and they threaten to kill you. For they said, verse 23, make us gods that shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. You know, the man. I mean, disrespectful, complainers. I mean, they're a bad example, really. And I said to them, whoever has any gold, let them break it off. So they gave it to me, and I cast it into the fire. And would you believe it? This calf came out. Isn't that amazing? Now, when Moses saw that, the people were unrestrained, for Aaron had not restrained them to their shame among their enemies, and the word unrestrained, the King James Version says, they were naked. And the NET translation says, they were running wild. This is where the orgy seems to come in. Verse 26, then Moses stood in the entrance of the camp and said, whoever is on the Lord's side, let him come to me. And all the sons of Levi gathered themselves together to him. So I don't think the party stopped. I think some of them were still running wild. And so Moses calls for those who want to support him. And the Levites come and, you know, and that's good for Levi, good for the Levites. That's why later on, you know, they're singled out for God's blessing. And he said to them, verse 27, thus says the Lord God of Israel, let every man put his sword on his side and go in and out from entrance to entrance throughout the camp. And let every man kill his brother, every man his companion, and every man his neighbor. I guess that's the ones who are still running wild. So the sons of Levi did according to the word of Moses, and about 3,000 men of the people fell that day. So that's, you know, pretty serious provocation. It did result in 3,000 people dying. But also, of course, yet another serious provocation of God to actually make a, you know, an animal. When God's only just perhaps a few thousand feet up the mountain from you, and you make an animal and worship it and run around naked and drunk and worship this animal. I mean, that's why God was about to sort of just flatten them until Moses stepped in and said, oh, no, please don't, please don't, please, please give them another chance. So that was number seven. Let's go on to the eighth provocation. Not very far to go, but we'll move on to Numbers chapter 10, read verse 33. So that was pretty much by Sinai, if you remember. So Numbers chapter 10, verse 33. So they departed from the mountain of the Lord on a journey of 3 days, and the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord went before them for the 3 days' journey to search out a resting place. So that's where they'd just been, with the incident of the golden calf was at Sinai, God's mountain. Now they've moved 3 days' journey. So not a lot of time, I think, has necessarily passed. we pick up this one in Numbers 11, verses 1 to 3, the eighth provocation, only 3 days' journey from Mount Sinai. Now, when the people complained, it displeased the Lord. Now, we don't have the details here of this complaint, other than it's yet another episode of grumbling, murmuring, of course, pretty much against God. The Amplified translation of this verse says, "And the people grumbled and deplored their hardships, which was evil in the ears of the Lord." So they're grumbling about life, grumbling about the journey. It's too long. It's too rough. It's too inconvenient. We're not happy. The Message translation says, "The people fell to grumbling over their hard life." Has there ever been a time where you or I have grumbled about our calling? Have we ever had a momentary doubt about going God's way and ever looked back at any point about those good old days and the flesh pots of our youth? Well, we have to be careful there. You know, God's working with us. We're on a journey to his kingdom. And we have to be very careful not to start to get very negative and get grumbling and complaining about the walk we have. So verse 1 again. "Now when the people complained, it displeased the Lord, for the Lord heard it, and his anger was aroused." The complaints must have been against God, clearly. "So the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed them, and consumed some in the outskirts of the camp. Then the people cried to Moses, and when Moses prayed to the Lord, the fire was quenched. So he called the name of the place Tabira, because the fire of the Lord had burned among them." You know, they probably hadn't really kept the vision of the promised land they were heading to. And sometimes for you and me, we look around us, we focus on the immediate that's just ahead of us, we focus on our conditions, we focus on how inconvenient, how sometimes it might be a bit harder than we'd like, and we forget the vision. We forget that we're heading towards God's promised land, his kingdom, that this age is hopefully not got too long to go, and then we've got the world tomorrow, the millennium. But if you forget the vision, if you don't see the promised land before your eyes, and just look at what's around, it's easy to start grumbling and complaining about my lot in life. If God hadn't called me, I'd have been a millionaire by now, running my brothel or whatever. Well, thankfully God called us, and we should be thankful of that. Let's move on to the ninth test, which is Numbers 11, 4 through 6. So, you know, they come pretty rapidly, these. It's one after another, verse 4 through 6. "Now the mixed multitude who were among them yielded to intense craving. So the children of Israel also wept again and said, 'Who will give us meat to eat?'" Well, the mixed multitude are the, one translation says riffraff.
Really?
The ISV, International Standard Version, says they are riffraff. The NIV, the Nearly Inspired Version, says rabble. So they're a rabble. And these would be people that came up with the Israelites from Egypt. It could be some Egyptians, possibly. It could be other, you know, slave folk who thought, "I'm getting out of here as well. Where they're going, I'm going." But these people were bad people. They were riffraff. They were rabble. And they're bad company. And you know what happens to bad company?
It corrupts
good manners. And you and I have to watch out for bad company. Don't be unequally yoked with unbelievers. Watch out. You know, bad company. You might think that you're immune to the influence of bad company. You're not. So anyway, Israel here has got plenty of problems. They are a really provocative lot. And they happen to be traveling with other folk who are, if anything, worse. The riffraff, the rabble. "Now the mixed multitude who were among them yielded to intense craving." So they start the process. "Oh, it's terrible here, isn't it? There's no meat to eat. There's lousy manna. And of course, it doesn't take long for that to rub off on our friendly Israelites, who are always prone to complaining. And it says, who will give us meat to eat? We remember. Do you remember the fish we ate freely in Egypt? The cucumbers? The melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic. Remember those days? But now our whole being is dried up. There's nothing at all except this manna before our eyes. Of course, actually, God's providing the manna every day. Is there any hint of gratitude here? Can't see any. There's certainly a hint of people who are motivated by their stomach. And again, looking back at the fond memories of life as a slave people, wasn't it wonderful? Do you remember being a slave, Ethel, in those days when we had cucumber at night? Before we had to be whipped the next day by the taskmasters? Do you remember those wonderful garlics, Ethel? It's not really very wise, is it? Dropping down to verses 10 to 15, you know, poor old Moses has about had enough now. Now Moses heard the people weeping throughout their families, everyone at the door of his tent, and the anger of the Lord was greatly aroused. Being provoked, you see. This is that again. You know, Moses also was displeased. So Moses said to the Lord, why have you afflicted your servant? Why have I not found favor in your sight that you've laid the burden of this lot on me? Did I conceive all these people? Did I beget them? That you should say to me, carry them in your bosom as a guardian carries a nursing child to the land which you swore to their fathers? Where am I to get meat to give all these people? For they weep all over me, saying, give us meat that we may eat. I'm not able to bear all these people alone. The burden's too heavy for me. You know what? If you treat me like this, well, just kill me here and now. If I found favour in your sight. And don't let me see my wretchedness. I've had enough. You know, don't drag it out. Just kill me now. So poor old Moses is ready for suicide. He's had enough of this lot. Can't take any more. And don't think God can take much more either. Because this is the ninth provocation and there were only 10. So it's getting pretty close to these people. They really ought to wake up, but it's not going to happen. Notice verses 18 through 23. Say to the people, sanctify yourselves for tomorrow, and you shall eat meat. For you have wept in the hearing of the Lord, saying, who will give us meat to eat? For it was well with us in Egypt, you know, like in Egypt, good old Egypt. Therefore the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat. You shall eat, not one day, nor 2 days, nor 5 days, nor 10 days, nor 20 days, but for a whole month, until it comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you, because you have despised the Lord who is among you, and have wept before him, saying, why did we ever come up out of Egypt? They're going to get meat all right, until they're sick of it. And Moses said, well, hang on a second. The people who I am among are 600,000 men on foot. And that'll be the women and the kids. It's going to be 2 million, 3 million. You've said, I will give them meat that they may eat for a whole month. Shall flocks and herds be slaughtered for them to provide enough for them? Or shall all the fish of the sea be gathered together for them to provide enough for them? How's this going to work? How does this happen? I can't see this, says Moses. The Lord said to Moses, has the Lord's hand arm been shortened? Now you shall see whether my word will befall you or not. And of course, we can think, you know, some centuries later, Jesus took a few little fish, a couple of loaves of bread, and fed, you know, 5,000. So, you know, God's always been able to feed large numbers with whatever he chooses. 2 or 3 million people in the wilderness, they want meat. They'll get meat all right. A month's supply of it. Versus 30. Drop down to verse 31. Now a wind went out from the Lord, and it brought quail. Birds, going to be the meat in question. Brought quail from the sea and left them fluttering near the camp, about a day's journey on this side, about a day's journey on the other side, all around the camp and about 2 cubits above the surface of the ground. And the people stayed up all that day, all that night, all the next day, and gathered the quail. He who gathered least gathered 10 homers. And they spread them out for themselves all around the camp. So here come the birds. And they're going to collect them and get a bit of meat because they're desperate for some meat. But he who gathered least, it says, gathered 10 homers. Now, a homer is just a cartoon, of course, on the TV. But a homer is a donkey load. So if you imagine a donkey and you sort of burden him with a very heavy load to carry, the load a donkey would carry would be about a homer. So the person who gathered least gathered 10 donkeys worth of quail. Now, why would you do that? Well, because you're greedy and gutsy. And also because you still get no trust. Because, as the preacher says, you never know what God's going to do. So I'm not going to get just 1 donkey load. I'm getting 10 donkey loads. I'm the minimalist here. Because my neighbour next to me has got 42 donkey loads of quail. So, greedy, run by the stomachs, out of control, you betcha. And the story has a little bit of an ending, verse 33 and 34. So while the meat was still between their teeth, before it was chewed, the wrath of the Lord was aroused against the people. And the Lord struck the people with a very great plague. So he called the name of that place Kibroth Hattaavah, meaning graves of lust, because there they buried the people who had yielded to craving. You can't imagine what it was like. Meat at last. They were probably chomping 2 quail at a time. You know, just a complete mess. I imagine it was probably equally zero gratitude. Did Emery say, please bless this quail, Lord, to our health and well-being. We thank you for it. Amen. No. They just dived on it. And while there was 2 or 3 quail stuffed in their mouth, God slew them. He just couldn't take any more until the final test, which we find in Numbers 13, the 10th provocation. Numbers 13, beginning in verse 23. And this was the one that brought it all to an end. And this is the line that they finally crossed. Numbers 13, verses 23 to 33. And of course what happened here was they come very close to the promised land. It was within sight. And so they sent out some spies to have a look around and come back and, you know, do some reconnaissance and tell us what we found. So they did that for 40 days, and they come back now with the story of what it's like. You know, we walked around, we've seen all these things, and here's our report. So picking up in verse 23, they came to the valley of Eshcol, and there cut down a branch with 1 cluster of grapes. They carried it between 2 of them on a pole. This is 1 cluster. It takes 2 folk to carry it. This is fruit, gorgeous fruit, juicy fruit, and it's big and luscious. This is an example of what's waiting for them once they cross over the border. They also brought some of the pomegranates, and figs, luscious. The place was called the Valley of Eshcol because of the cluster which the men of Israel cut down there, and they returned from spying out the land after 40 days. So they departed and came back to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the children of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. They brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. And they told him, saying, we went to the land where you sent us. It truly flows with milk and honey, and this is an example of its fruit. This is good news. It's just like God said. It's a land flowing with milk and honey. You can't believe what it's like over there. Unfortunately, it didn't stop there. Nevertheless, because there's always a but with some people. Yeah, I know God said that, but. I know God said do that, but. I know God said he blessed me, but. Well, verse 28 is a big but. Nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong. The cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there, and we all know about Anak. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south. The Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Trilobites, whoever else is there, dwell in the mountains. And the Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the banks of the Jordan. So, bad people there. Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people. We just can't, for they are stronger than we are." And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants. All the people whom we saw are men of great stature. They're big. They're beefy. There we saw the giants, or Nephilim, in the margin. The descendants of Anak came from the giants, and we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight." So they bring this terrible report. I mean, it's the worst of all things. The land's got great fruit, pomegranates and figs and grapes, but we can't go there because the people are big and mean and nasty. And don't forget, the sons of Anak, of all people, are over there. We can't do it. Chapter 14, verses 1 through 10. "Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night." And of course, they were very experienced weepers. "And all the children of Israel murmured." Would you believe that? Isn't that amazing? After such confident displays of faith up till now in God. "And all the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, 'If only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if only we had died in this wilderness.'" Oops. "You need to be careful what we say. 'Why has the Lord brought us out to this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and children should become victims? Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt, to our former lives?' And they said to one another, 'Let us select a leader and return to Egypt.'" What does God make of this? The land is, you know, a few hundred yards away. A land flowing with milk and honey and grapes and pomegranates and figs and, you know, the coastline where you can go fishing. And they're saying, "Why has God brought us here to kill us all? If only we died." Well, this is really foolish. "Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before the assembly of the congregation, and Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who spied out the land, tore their clothes and spoke to all the congregation, saying, 'Look, the land we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only, do not rebel against the Lord.'" Because they can see that's what's happening. It's something that's obvious. "Do not rebel against Jehovah, nor fear the people of the land, for they are our bread. Their protection's departed from them. The Lord Jehovah is with us. Do not fear them." And all the congregation said, "Amen, brother, let us go. Lead on, God. We're your people. You're our God." And all the congregation said, "Stone them with stones." So the rebellion is it's set. "Now the glory of the Lord appeared in the tabernacle meeting before all the children of Israel." And of course, God says to Moses, "That's it. That's it. Get out of the way. I'm going to destroy them right now. And I'll start again, Moses, with you." And of course, we've been there before. And Moses says, "Don't. Your reputation will be shredded if it turns out you bring the people out." And people say, "Well, he couldn't bring them into the land. This God's not all-powerful. So please, God, don't destroy them now." So verses 11 and 12, "The Lord said to Moses, 'How long will these people reject me? How long will they not believe me with all the signs which I performed among them? I will strike them with the pestilence and disinherit them and make you a nation greater and mightier than they. And of course, Moses is successful with his intercession. We pick up where we were earlier in verses 19 through 24. Pardon the iniquity of this people, says Moses. I pray according to the greatness of your mercy, just as you have forgiven them from Egypt even until now. And that was the preceding nine provocations in just a few weeks. The Lord said, okay, I have pardoned according to your word. But truly, as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord, because all these men who have seen my glory and the signs which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness and have put me to the test now these 10 times and have not heeded my voice, they certainly shall not see the land of which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who rejected me see it. And that's going to be 600,000 footmen, a similar number perhaps of women, perhaps some others on top of that. So 1 or 2 million people who should have been a week later in the promised land are going to die in the wilderness. But my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit in him and has followed me fully, I will bring into the land where he went, and his descendants shall inherit it, as well as, of course, you know, Joshua. Dropping down to verse 26. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, how long shall I bear with this evil congregation who murmur endlessly against me? I have heard the murmurings which the children of Israel murmur against me. Say to them, as I live, says the Lord, just as you spoke to my hearing, so I will do to you. May you say I brought you up to kill you? Okay, I'm going to. The carcasses of you who have murmured against me shall fall in this wilderness, all of you who were numbered, according to your entire number, from 20 years old and above. So if you're 20 plus, you've got a death sentence.
Wow.
You're not going across. It's just over there, just over that hill. And I wanted you to go there. It's my desire, it's my will for you. But I'm not taking you. You've crossed the line. 10 provocations in as many weeks, you're not going across. Except for Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun, you shall by no means enter the land which I swore I would make you dwell in. But your little ones, whom you said would be victims, I will bring in, and they shall know the land which you have despised. But as for you, your carcasses shall fall in this wilderness, and your sons shall be shepherds in the wilderness 40 years. Wow, this isn't just a brief, you know, month or two's punishment. 40 years, and bear the brunt of your infidelity, your lack of faith, until your carcasses are consumed in this wilderness, according to the number of days in which you spied out the land, 40 days. For each day you shall bear your guilt 1 year, namely 40 years. And you shall know my rejection. You know, you've rejected me, I'm rejecting you. I, the Lord, have spoken this. I surely will do so to all this evil congregation who are gathered together against me. I mean, that's the way it was. This million plus adults were gathered together of one mind against Jehovah God. I mean, how stupid can you get? Other than the fact, of course, that Paul says we've got to learn not to make the same mistakes. And these things are written down for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. And we should take heed, lest we fall. Anyway, he says, in this wilderness they shall be consumed, and there they shall die. You know, God is extremely patient. I think we all know that. That's why the world is still here at the moment. But, you know, somewhere there's a line, and none of us want to take a chance of crossing it, do we? You know, people have said, well, God took, you know, the people out of Egypt. He just couldn't take Egypt out of the people. Their minds were just bent, twisted, corrupt. He couldn't do it. And you and I have got to do what they didn't. We've got to learn to walk by faith, not by sight, which is all they seem to do. We've got to be people who are generally grateful people, not a grumbling people. We shouldn't have any desire to go back to Egypt, back to our former lives, our old way of life. Is that still attractive to us? We still remember the flesh pots, the garlics, the cucumbers. And, of course, we would be better to model ourselves on Joshua and Caleb, on the few, not the many. You know, most who left Egypt didn't arrive in the Promised Land. They didn't walk by faith, didn't finish the race. Is there a lesson there for us? Hopefully we can see there's lots of lessons this time of year as we rehearse the story of ancient Israel at Passover time, the night much remembered, leaving Egypt, leaving Pharaoh, leaving slavery, leaving bondage, heading on the way to the Promised Land. There's so much around that story that pictures our calling and our lives. A great time of year, every year, to read these things and reflect on them. And so the Feast of Unleavened Bread is coming to a close. Only a few hours left, but obviously the lessons of leaving sin, the lessons of living and walking by faith, those lessons we should take with us. And there are many lessons surrounding these events, these stories of the Exodus. And like I said earlier, it's better to learn their lessons from reading the scriptures than to learn the painful lessons of actually doing it all ourselves. We don't need that painful experience. The lessons are there for our admonition, for our warning, for our instruction. That's why they're there. Gives us an easier way to learn important lessons. Let's look finally at Romans 15, verses 4 and 13. Romans 15, our final verse. Romans chapter 15, verse 4, and then I think 13. So I get why people like the New Testament. Some of the letters are quite short. And it may in places seem a bit more relevant in practical living, but the Old Testament scriptures are valuable. It's all inspired for our correction and to instruct us in righteousness. And notice here in verse 4, Romans 15, whatever things were written before were written for our learning. And I think Paul means us. Not written for their learning. I mean, they learned the hard way. They did it. And of course, in this case, we're looking at many died in the wilderness. But these things, it says, whatever things were written before were written for our learning, that we, us believers, us followers of Christ, through the patience and comfort of the scriptures, might have hope. Which scriptures, by the way? Which scriptures were in existence when Paul wrote to the Romans? Well, amongst other things, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, where we've just been. And notice verse 13 in closing. Now may the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing, that you may abound in hope by the power of the Holy Spirit. So we have a hope, and it says here we should be filled with joy and peace in believing. You know, it's just great to know of God's holy days, his feast days, his purpose and plan. The world doesn't. There's very, very few people, I imagine, keeping the Feast of Unleavened Bread today. Most folk are ignorant of it. Those few people who study their Bibles just think it's a Jewish festival done away in the Old Covenant. So for you and me, you know, these feast days are really precious and very valuable to us. So I guess we enjoy them and, of course, keep on keeping them. And with that, we'll close today's message.